We now go to the Windsor, Detroit area, where an alien craft has just landed.
I want you men to surround the craft. Chris, you stay with me.
What are we going to do, Jeff?
We're going in.
What? They're extraterrestrials.
What are you doing here? Why have you come here?
We have come here to listen to 99.1 FM CJAM.
99.1 FM CJAM, redefining radio in Windsor and Detroit.
It's time for You Talking to Me with your host, Big JD.
Biologist Dr. Khan Slobodjikov says it really is possible for humans to communicate with the other creatures of the Earth. Considered a real-life Dr. Doolittle, Khan is on the show today to discuss animal behavior and communication amongst themselves and with us, and as well his passion for studying prairie dogs. Khan, welcome to You Talking to Me.
Thank you.
So you say the whole world is talking, we just don't know how to listen, or at least yet. Can you explain that?
Sure. The evidence now is that a lot of animals are communicating with each other with things that we would call language. In other words, they are communicating deliberately information to each other. They're making choices about what to communicate. They're making choices about how to communicate. But we as humans at the moment think that animals aren't capable of language. We think that we are the only ones who are actually capable of language. And so we tend to discount the possibility that animals are actually communicating meaningful information to each other. So that's what I mean about the whole world talking. Lots of animals are using language to communicate, but we're not listening because we're not yet prepared to listen.
We'll get more into some specific languages, but have you found any similarities between any certain species?
Among the mammals, there are some similarities, particularly in body language. One of the similarities is that when animals tend to crouch down, that means that they're afraid, that means that they're being submissive, that means that they're willing to let another individual have its own way. And when they stretch out to their full height, that means that they're being angry or aggressive. Same thing with their vocalizations. If, say, animals are speaking in a very low voice, a very deep voice, this is seen as more of an aggressive kind of situation. Whereas if they're speaking in a much higher voice, this is more indicative of fear, of submissiveness. So there are some generalities. But generally speaking, each animal species tends to have its own language.
I should ask you about how many species you've been able to study. I mean, do you study marine animals as well as land?
No, actually, in terms of my research as a scientist, I've concentrated on prairie dogs, specifically Denison's prairie dog, where over the space of about 25 years and doing a series of detailed experiments and analyzing the results statistically, my team and I have found that prairie dogs have a very sophisticated language. They have words for different predators. So, for example, they have one word for a coyote, another word for a domestic dog, another word for a human, another word for a badger, another one for a red-tailed hawk. And amazingly enough, within that, they're able to describe the physical features of individual predators. So, for example, for a human, they're able to describe the general size and shape of the human. They're able to describe the color of clothes of the human. They're able to say whether the human has a gun or doesn't have a gun.
Wow.
They're able to remember that information. So when the human comes out with a gun and then later comes out without a gun, they still describe him as a dangerous individual. So it's a very sophisticated kind of language. And that has caused me to start thinking about the possibility of other animals having languages as well. We know, for example, that marine animals like whales and dolphins produce all kinds of different sounds, but we haven't really been able to look at them in an organized way in terms of context, the way that I've been able to do it with prairie dogs, to decode complete language. See, with prairie dogs, one of the things that has given me the key to decoding their language, what I call my Rosetta Stone, is that they produce alarm calls when a predator shows up. And so we can videotape the predator, we can videotape the escape responses of the prairie dogs, we can record the alarm calls, and then when no predator is around, we can play back to the prairie dogs the alarm calls that we recorded for that predator and videotape their escape responses. And if they do the same thing when no predator is there, then we know that they've understood the message, that there is meaningful information in that alarm call. And by doing these kinds of experiments and carefully teasing apart all of the different elements and analyzing each experiment statistically, we've been able to put together this picture that I outlined for you, where they are able to describe a variety of different things going on in their environment. And this is the kind of thing that we need to look at with other animal species as well. And in the book that I have just published, Chasing Dr. Doolittle, I provide a lot of information that we already have about lots of other animal species to show that we already have the pieces that we can put together to say that lots of other animals have language as well.
Right, and we'll talk about some interesting ways that we are going to be able to do that, and also possibly using technology. Now, your interest in prairie dogs, but how did that come about? Was it because maybe your area, they're more abundant, or?
Well, actually, it's kind of a funny story, because initially, when I first came to Arizona, I was interested in desert beetles that have defensive secretions. Mm. And these desert beetles, when they're attacked by a predator, they do a headstand. They stick their butt up in the air and stick up like a post. And if a predator attacks them, they squirt out of their butt these defensive secretions, which are very unpleasant, very toxic. And a predator like a mammalian, one like a skunk or a rat, spends some of its time running around, rubbing its tongue in the sand, trying to scrape all of these defensive secretions off.
Mm-hmm.
There are other beetles that do exactly the same thing, but they don't have defensive secretions, so they mimic the ones that do. And I was interested in finding out what kinds of predators are able to make the distinction between the mimics and the ones that squirt, and which ones couldn't.
Mm.
And so I had these beetles in my lab. One day I walked into my lab, took a deep breath, and my lungs started filling with fluid. And I thought, uh-oh, I've gotten allergic to them. And I should have known this, because one of the major components of these defensive secretions is quinones, which at that time photographers used in their development solutions. And I knew that photographers got allergic to quinones within a couple of months if they didn't take precautions.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't take precautions because I never thought it would happen to me. So, because part of my job involved doing research, I realized I have to have another research project. And at the time, around my university, Northern Arizona University at Flagstaff, there were lots of prairie dogs. And I thought, prairie dogs, these would be fascinating creatures to work with. We know that they're social. Maybe they have an interesting communication system. So I started working with prairie dogs and found that increasingly, the more experiments that I did, the more sophisticated the communication system turned out to be.
Pretty incredible, especially in studying the animals, being able to differentiate between which of those beetles were actually able to secrete that solution.
Yeah, we found actually, interestingly enough, that skunks had a very fascinating way of approaching these beetles. They couldn't tell which ones squirt or not, so they would approach and get an initial squirt. And then if the beetle started to squirt, what they would do is they would take their front paws and roll the beetle in the sand. And as the beetle was being rolled, it would squirt its secretions, and periodically the skunk would take a small sample, get squirted, shake its head vigorously, continue rolling until the beetle ran out of secretions, and then the skunk would eat it. Sort of like getting mugged by a skunk.
Wow, that's kind of funny, and that's from one animal that secretes as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, tell me a little bit about the Prairie Dog Coalition.
The Prairie Dog Coalition is a group of scientists, environmentalists, activists, biologists, people who are concerned about prairie dogs, because they're concerned about prairie dog conservation. Here's what's happening with prairie dogs. There are five species of prairie dogs in the world. All of them are in North America, and all of them are declining at a very fast rate. Now there's about roughly between 1 and 2% of the prairie dogs existing presently that we had 100 years ago. So they're rapidly disappearing. And the reason that this is of some concern, other than just for animals in general, is that prairie dogs are what are called keystone species. In other words, when they come into a grassland, they modify the habitat by digging burrows, by clipping certain plants, letting other plants grow. They modify the habitat to increase the general species diversity of everything in the grassland, both plants and animals. So we know that there's something like 200 different species of vertebrates that, to some extent or other, depend on prairie dogs and their burrows. They hide in the burrows. They sleep in the burrows. Burrow owls nest inside the burrows. There's also a number of arthropods, spiders and beetles and other insects that use the burrows. And lots of large animals, like antelope and bison, what we call buffalo, tend to graze on the enhanced species diversity of plants around prairie dog towns. So they modified the habitat in such a way that lots of other animals can exist in these grassland prairies. And so the Prairie Dog Coalition is trying to promote the idea of conserving the prairie dogs. And okay. Sometimes this is an uphill battle because many people don't like prairie dogs.
Why don't they like them?
Partly it dates back to old-time attitudes when American settlers were settling in the West. There were lots of prairie dogs, and prairie dog colonies went on for miles and miles and miles, something you never see anymore. The settlers introduced cattle into these plains, and initially the settlers, with very little evidence, thought that cattle and prairie dogs competed for the same grass with each other. And so they started killing off the prairie dogs, trying to promote the idea that if they did that, there would be more grass for the cattle. We now know from some experiments that actually prairie dogs sometimes can enhance the weight of the cattle, because by clipping selective vegetation, they cause this vegetation to resprout, and when the vegetation resprouts, it's very tender, lacking all of those silicates and other things that are in old leaves, and so the cattle can digest it better, and the cattle put on more weight. But this is still controversial because there have been very few studies that actually have looked at this question. It's been more an attitudinal question that people have assumed, well, if prairie dogs eat grass and if cattle eat grass, obviously they must be competing with each other.
I'm sure many listeners are interested in us talking a little bit about domestic pets, dogs and cats. You say most people misinterpret their pets' attempts at communication.
For a number of years, I used to do behavioral consulting with people about problems that they have with their pets. And so I would go to people's homes and I would look at problem animals, and people would describe to me what the problem was. And I would say that about 80% of the time, they would completely misinterpret what the problem was. For example, they would say, my dog is acting very aggressive. My dog is trying to bite me. And I would go into their house, and I would look at the dog. And clearly with the dog's body language, the dog was not being aggressive. The dog was being frightened by something. The dog would crouch down. Remember what I was saying about how animals would crouch down when they were frightened? The dog would crouch down. The ears were flattened. The tail was pressed up against the body. And there was something in the environment that was frightening the person. And often, it was the way that the people interacted with the dog. For example, there might be a male in the household, a man in the household, who was in saying good dog to the animal, would bark, good dog! And this was not only loud, but this was a low-pitched voice, and the dog would be scared.
Sure.
And so, being frightened, the dog would cower in a corner, and the man would reach his hand over to try to drag the dog out, and the dog would try to bite the man, and then the man would hit the dog, and this would reinforce the idea in the dog's mind that this was a scary person.
Right.
And so, a lot of times, people just didn't understand what was going on with their pets. For example, with cats. Somebody would come in and they would say, my cat is peeing all over my bed. What can I do? And I would look around. The first thing that I would notice as I walk in is that there's a smell of cat pee throughout the house. And I would follow the strongest smell of cat pee and find that here's a litter box that is just filled with cat pee.
Mm-hmm.
And people didn't change the litter box. And so the first thing that I would say is, have you considered changing the litter box on a daily basis? Well, no, we haven't. Cats are very fastidious, and I try to explain to them that what your cat is actually trying to tell you by peeing on the bed is, please change my litter box. I really want a clean place to pee in. I really don't want to pee on your bed. I really want to pee in my litter box, but it's so gross that I can't go in there. So there's a lot of misunderstandings that people have that if they only understood a little bit more about what their animals are trying to communicate to them, these misunderstandings could be easily cleared up.
And now, is communication generally more a behavioral thing? I know you mentioned behavioral, but can people actually talk to animals? Is it possible to telepathically speak to an animal or to know what they're saying by their barking or the way that they meow, what they might be actually speaking?
Well, I know that there are people who say that they can telepathically communicate with animals, and I really have no opinion on that. I really have no evidence one way or another whether they can or not.
Sure.
I looked at it from the standpoint of a scientist, you know, what can we prove experimentally?
Mm-hmm.
And as a scientist, our experimental methods usually involve replicating with a number of different animals so that we can get a statistical sample that is large enough that allows us to say something about this. Whereas with telepathy, you know, we have only a one-time instance where somebody comes in and says, my dog is trying to say this or that, and we don't really have enough of a sample size to be able to say, yes, this works, or no, it doesn't work. But that said, you can learn a lot in terms of how the animals are using body language, how the animals are using sound, recognizing that the animals might have words in their sounds, and trying to learn what those words mean. And I talk to a lot of people who have dogs who tell me that their dogs clearly have different words that they use for different situations, and the people have learned these different words. So the dog will have one word for feed me, another word for I want to go for a walk, and so on. And the people have learned this, and when the dog makes this particular sound, they follow through and do this kind of thing.
I'm kind of curious if you're familiar with that. The gorilla, I don't think it's any longer alive, Coco, who, you know, was well-versed in sign language, and I kind of wonder how intelligent other animals might be, maybe, you know, that can't necessarily sign, but that's pretty incredible that a gorilla would be able to use sign language and communicate with humans.
Sure, Coco is a great example. There have been other examples. There's a bonobo, which is related to a chimp called Kanzi, who is able to use a computer keyboard to communicate, and also has learned a number of English words. And there have been dogs, for example, who have learned a number of words. There's a border collie called Chaser, who knows somewhere upwards of about 1,000 words in English. There's a border collie called Rico in Germany who knows somewhere upwards of about 200 words in English. So if you tell Chaser to go find a doll, for example, or a particular doll, Chaser will know where to go and how to find it. So there's a lot of evidence that animals can understand our language and can use our language to communicate with each other and with ourselves. For example, there's another chimp who's not alive anymore called Washo, and Washo was taught American Sign Language just like Coco, and Washo used this language with an adopted chimp of hers, and she even molded the chimp's fingers into the correct signs.
Wow.
Teaching the chimp how to use those signs.
When we come back, more about animal communication with Dr. Khan Slobodchikov.
Do you have an interesting career? You have an interesting life experience to share with others? If you'd like to be a guest on You Talking to Me, contact me, Big JD, at the You Talking to Me website. That's youtalkingtome.ca. The letter U, talking, the number two, me, youtalkingtome.ca.
We're back. Biologist Dr. Khan Slobodchikov on the show today. In your opinion, what's the most intelligent animal based on communication skills besides humans, or are we not the smartest?
This is something that's very hard to define. You know, what is intelligence in the first place? And one of the things that we know is that whales and dolphins have brains that are roughly comparable to ours. Their brain body mass is roughly comparable to our brain body mass ratios, and they are incredibly intelligent. But how do you measure this kind of intelligence? You know, it's sort of, we were talking about Coco, for example, and Coco, as a gorilla, had certain tendencies that were characteristic of gorillas. So when Coco was given an IQ test that was designed for nonverbal children, where you were shown pictures and you had to pick what was the correct picture. For example, one of the questions that I recall from this was, Coco was asked, what's good to eat? And one of the things was a cookie, and one of the things was a flower. And Coco chose flower, which counted wrong on the intelligence test, but was absolutely right for what gorillas do, because gorillas are vegetarians and they like to eat flowers. So the question is, how do you really get at the intelligence of other species that live in different environments that have different needs? And it's a hard question to answer.
You mentioned your book, Chasing Dr. Doolittle. Tell us a little more about that.
In Chasing Dr. Doolittle, what I tried to do was I tried to put together a lot of evidence that we have in the published scientific literature about animals using language or using pieces of language to show that it's not only us, but, for example, lizards have grammar in how they use their mating systems. They adjust the position of their legs. They adjust the push-ups that they do in their displays to females or to other males, and that this follows certain rules just like our grammar follows certain rules. Squid, for example, will change the signals that they display on their body. They have cells called chromatophores, which can either expand or contract in the blink of an eye and change the color of the squid, change the pattern of lines on the squid, and so squid can communicate with each other to say, I want to mate with you, or I want to fight with you, or go away, or so on. And we are beginning to scratch the surface of this, but there's a lot of evidence to show that animals can do this. Whales, for example, humpback whales will sing songs, and pretty much everybody knows this, but what people may not know is that about 40% of the time, the whales, in singing their songs, rhyme the ending parts of the songs, just like we rhyme the ending words of our song. And we don't know why this happens. Maybe it's so that they can remember it better. We don't know. And there's a lot of fascinating stuff. Like, for example, if you take a whale song and speed it up some 16 times, it sounds just like bird song. If you take bird song and slow it down 16 times, it sounds just like whale song. So there's a lot of interesting details that we are beginning to appreciate. And in Chasing Dr. Doolittle, what I try to do is I try to approach the whole question of animal language with the possibility that animals do have language. And in the process, I also had a lot of fun putting in a lot of anecdotes that I had with animals from all over the world. I've been in many places in the world. I've interacted with a lot of different animals in the world. And I tell anecdotes about my experiences with these animals, what it was like being there, what it was like interacting with these animals, what it was like trying to pay attention to these animals. So I tried to put this into a book that was readable, enjoyable, not a dry scientific text, not a series of lectures that are dull and boring, but I tried to make it really lively so that a lot of people could enjoy it.
And the book is available at all online retailers?
Yes, it's available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. And as far as I know, it should be available in brick-and-mortar stores, Barnes & Noble, independent bookstores as well. It's published by St. Martin's Press, which is a large New York City publisher, and so they have a very wide distribution network. And as far as I know, it's been distributed pretty much everywhere.
You have a website as well for more information. What's your website?
My website is www.conslobotchikov.com.
Sure, and as well, we'll have a link on the You Talking to Me website for listeners. You've talked a little bit about technology, a chimp, I believe it was, using a computer, and also slowing down bird song or speeding up whale song, and obviously that requires some type of technology. Now, when you talk about technology or computers aiding us in animal communication, are those some of the things that fall under that category, or are there other things that we're going to be aided by computers to be able to do these things?
No, I think that one of the promising things about using computers and technology is that in the future, and perhaps not in the very distant future, it will really allow us to talk to animals in a meaningful way. Let me give you an example. With decoding the language of prairie dogs, I've been working with a computer scientist colleague, and we've been using artificial intelligence techniques to have the vocalizations of the prairie dogs come into the computer, and the computer then automatically figures out what the prairie dogs are saying and can spit this back to us in English. And it also has the potential of us saying in English something and the computer using its artificial intelligence program to figure out what we're saying and spit it back in prairie dog terms. Now, I think that this is something that can be applied to all animals in general. And I think that we are very close to having the capability of having something maybe about the size of a cell phone, maybe a small recorder, and saying to our dog, what would you like? And the dog goes, woof, and the device says, I want to go for a walk. Or saying to our cat, what's up? And the cat says, meow, and the device says, it's time to feed me, stupid.
I'm sure Google's working on that now.
I don't know who's working on that, but we have the capability of that in the very not distant future.
Right.
And we also have the capability of doing that with farm animals, for example. Mm-hmm. We know that cattle will get frightened by things that we don't even realize. For example, a red bandana might scare a cow into running and might cause a stampede where cattle are injured. Now, if we had a device that allowed the cows to talk to us, the cow could say, this red bandana scares me.
Sure.
And we can do something about it. So I think that this is just around the corner, and what I think it'll do is it will greatly improve our relationship with animals in general.
Of course, my dig on Google is not at you guys as scientists, but you know, with Google's Translate apps for the phones and things like sure. That's what I was talking about there. Now, you're also involved in a number of other things, and I'd like to get a few of these things in before we come to a close with the show. And so I want to ask you about Heart of Stone Studio.
HeartofStoneStudio.com is a website that is run by my wife, who is actually an animal behaviorist also. She has a PhD in animal behavior. But she has found that she has a passion for gemstones. And she also has a good eye for picking out really high-quality gemstones. Mm-hmm. So she has on her site a number of semi-precious gemstones, like opals, for example, like jaspers, like quartz, and so on, that people can incorporate into their jewelry. And she also has a lot of artistic tendencies, and so combining the artistic tendencies with her knowledge of technology, with her good eye for what constitutes a high-quality stone, she sells these things on the website to artists, to jewelry artists, to people who like really nice quality stones.
You also blog quite a bit, and tell us a couple of the areas where you most frequently blog, so that possibly listeners can check out some of your writing as well there.
Sure. One of the major places where I blog is on dogbehaviorblog.com. And in there, I write about dog behavior. What I try to do is I try to have short, interesting articles about what we're finding out in scientific experiments that is directly translated into what people can do about their dogs and how people can understand their dogs. For example, I have an article in there about how dogs laugh. We didn't know that dogs laughed until people did some experiments and did some high-speed recordings to find that when dogs pant in a certain way, that's laughter. They're having a good time. And so I try to present information like that to people so that they can better understand their dog. I also have another blog called ReconnectWithNatureBlog.com, where I try to bring in scientific evidence about our understanding of nature in general and how we can appreciate nature and how science can help us appreciate nature. I basically see science being something that is an aid to people understanding animals and understanding nature, and not something that's sterile and off by itself in some sort of hallowed hall that we can't approach and we can't touch.
I want to ask you about the other communication and behavioral skills or emotion of animals, and things like jealousy, willpower, hate. Do animals create that, you know, within their species? Are they, do they understand that at all, or is that something that's just man-made?
Well, once again, in the past, we thought that this was something that was unique to humans and that animals didn't have this because animals functioned on programs of instincts where essentially you push the green button and you have a certain output and you push the yellow button and you have a different output, and all of this was controlled by genes. But now we know that this is not the case, that animals have a lot of cognitive skills and they can make decisions, and some of the decisions are things like jealousy and hate and morality and so on. And there's a number of scientists now who are beginning to explore this question, and they're finding, just like I found with language, they're finding that animals can experience pleasure. Animals have a certain moral code. Animals can experience envy. Animals can experience jealousy. For example, there's a recent study with dogs where two dogs were asked to perform the same task, but one dog was rewarded much more than the dog. And so after a while, the dog that was rewarded less stopped working, said, "Wait a minute, what's going on here?" And the dog stopped working.
And tell us about the Animal Language Institute.
I set up the Animal Language Institute with colleagues of mine who were also interested in animal language as a way of trying to bring together scientists who are working on animal communication who might be interested in extending this to animal language. And initially we had a fairly elaborate website on this where we had a lot of information about animal language. Unfortunately, the software program that we were using changed, and we could no longer afford the upgrade to the software program. So now we just have a simple web page that announces some of our principles. But the idea is still that we are trying to encourage scientists and interested amateurs and people in the general public who are interested in animal language to come together and share ideas about what they think and share stories about their experiences with animal language. Even though scientists work along the scientific method where we have experiments and we have statistical analysis and so on, stories about things are a good starting point, because stories are what give us ideas about future directions for research. So I was trying to get people to share their stories, to share their experiences with this.
All right. Once again, your website is www.conslobodchikov.com. You're doing some fantastic work, Con, and we wish you the best with that and your research. And thank you for being on the show today.
Oh, thank you, Big JD.
Visit conslobodchikov.com for more information on animal behavior and communication. Check out the fine work he's doing, and he has a number of books available. Who knows? Soon, you might be having a conversation with your own dog or cat. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening.